Hi, folks. I'm Bob Main. You're listening to another episode of the Handgun World Podcast. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. This is episode number 340. Obviously, the title of this is Revolving Doctor, and you'll understand why I gave it that title when I get to the interview portion of this episode. We do talk a fair deal about revolvers, and I haven't talked much about revolvers on this show, but lately students have been coming through the classes that Ben and I have been teaching with revolvers, and revolvers are very formidable weapons. There's nothing wrong with a revolver, you know, other than the fact that most of them only hold five or six rounds. You know, revolvers can be an extremely, if you know how to use them, they can be an extremely good self-defense weapon. So I do want to say something about revolvers. You know, last week when I was training and doing some practicing at a place to shoot with Alan and Luis and Hank over at a place to shoot, practicing some of the fundamentals, you know, Alan was using a revolver and he was doing pretty well with it. You know, the thing I wanted to mention is, you know, I learned there one of the things that we talked about tactically. Revolvers can sometimes be good in a real close quarters confrontation. In other words, a real up close and personal confrontation with a bad guy, a battle up close. And you know what happens with a lot of women when they get attacked? What do a lot of the male aggressors do? They'll typically be very, very close to a woman and they will overpower her. And oftentimes the attack comes when basically the bad guy is within a foot or even grabbing a hold of her. And this is where a revolver can really shine, because you know, it's not that easy for a revolver to malfunction. You know, I would say it's more easy for a semi-automatic to malfunction in a close quarters combat situation like that many women are going to find themselves in. Many times a woman's going to have to draw that gun and basically, you know, stick it in the bad guy's ribs or stick it in the bad guy's chest or whatever and pull the trigger. And if you're doing that, a revolver really shines, because I don't know if you know, on a semi-automatic, all you got to do is push the slide back a little bit on the semi-automatic. Just push it out of battery. Just a little bit, quarter of an inch maybe. You push that slide back a quarter of an inch. If a bad guy does that for a split second, that semi-automatic revolver or semi-automatic handgun is not effective. Okay, it's harder to do that with a revolver. Not impossible. A bad guy could grab a hold of the cylinder and stop it from turning, and then that way you can't fire the gun. But that's a lot less likely, in my opinion, than pushing a semi-automatic out of battery. Also, the other thing is, most semi-automatic pistols, if the bad guy knows the proper way to take a gun away from somebody, basically he can gain control of that, whereas it's a little harder with these snub-nosed revolvers, because they don't have a slide for somebody to grab onto. All they have is basically a little barrel sticking out. And so, you know, smaller guns are really, they're much harder for a gun grab to take place. In other words, it's much more difficult for a bad guy to do that, to grab your gun. So there is a place, up close and personal, there's a lot less chance for malfunctions with a small revolver. Again, as I mentioned, those small revolvers are no fun to shoot. And if a woman is going to own that, or even if a guy is going to own that, if you're going to own a small revolver, you better be willing to practice with it a lot. Now, you know, Ben Branham's got a Ruger LCR, and I really do like the Ruger LCRs if you're going to get a small revolver. I really like that. I've heard that Ruger's coming out with a 327 Magnum. Hey, you should look into that. I believe it's going to be six rounds instead of five, which is good. You get that one extra round. And I just might pick one of those up once they're out and they're shipping, those Ruger 327 Magnums. There's nothing wrong with a 327 Magnum round. You should look at the ballistics on it. If I can find some ballistics, I'll put a link to it in the show notes. I think that'd be a cool revolver. Yeah, it's another caliber to manage, but I think it would be kind of a cool revolver to own And like I said, I get six rounds instead of five in a snub-nosed revolver. It's an effective cartridge. It's easy to shoot. And even if you get a 38 special, a Ruger LCR 38 special, or a Smith & Wesson 642. Smith & Wesson 642 is not that bad to shoot. It's not much fun, but it's, you know, it's... I mean, if you are willing to run, I would say if you're willing to practice 50 to 100 rounds a month, minimum, a month. Not once, not twice a year, a month. If you're willing to practice a good 50 to 100 rounds a month and make it real good quality practice, like practice drawing that revolver, getting it on target, or even shooting it from an unconventional position to where you can't fully extend your arms and get it on target, but let's say a bad guy does have you wrapped in his arms and he's trying to wrestle you to the ground or do whatever, or throw you into the back of a van, you know, can in that situation, can you get that revolver out and can you press it into his rib cage or whatever and pull the trigger and do it effectively? So, you know, we do talk about revolvers in this episode. And that's all I wanted to say about revolvers right now in the introduction. So let's get to the interview. I recently had a chance to interview Dr. John Adine. Now, you've heard Dr. Adine on several podcasts. I had him on this podcast once before talking about Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. Dr. Adine is a doctor here in San Antonio. I'll let him tell you about that when we get to the interview. He's been through several of the classes that Ben and I have taught. He's a great guy. I'm glad I've got a chance to get to know him personally. And I'm very impressed with his abilities on the shooting range. So let's get to it. My interview recently with Dr. John Adine. Well, for the interview portion of this podcast, I'm with Dr. John Adine, who's been on a lot of podcasts lately. Welcome to the show, John.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you. We had a great class today. It was a lot of fun. We had some good shooters and... got a little toasty out there at the end, but it was a good day all around.
Yeah, it was. How many times have you taken Beyond Concealed Carry?
Just twice.
Okay, this is your second time.
Yeah, the first time I took it with my Glock 17, this time with the Smith & Wesson 686 revolver.
Hey, by the way, you shot that Smith & Wesson 686. For those who don't know, it's a 357 Magnum revolver. It's a big, giant, heavy revolver, but you shot it well.
Well, thanks. I have to credit Grant Cunningham for some good instruction when I took his course this summer. So I'm just trying to keep my skills up.
Well, you know, hey, Grant, if you're listening, you did a good job training John. John, for people who haven't heard you that might be tuning in for the first time, tell them a little bit about what you do and your association with Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership.
Yeah. Well, I'm a pediatric orthopedic surgeon in San Antonio. I've been here for the last 18 years. And I'm still in active practice. A couple of years ago, I ended up going to Gun Rights Policy Conference and met Tim Wheeler, who's the founder of Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. And you know, I was very frustrated with the fact that we have to disarm ourselves when we walk into hospitals. So it's kind of become my calling to try to get rid of gun-free zones. And in the midst of all this, I've also been asked to be part of the leadership of Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. I'm the membership director.
That's what I thought, membership.
Membership director. And so one of the things that I do is try to get new members. A couple of weeks ago, we were at Gun Rights Policy Conference, and I talked about the terrorist threat against hospitals. And
talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a study that was done by the Israelis in 2013. They actually looked at over 100 terrorist attacks against hospitals worldwide in 43 countries. There were 776 more fatalities and over 1,700 wounded. So we talked about the fact that hospitals are a soft target. And not only are they a soft target, but they contain biological agents, radiological agents, and health information. So they can be misused by whatever terrorist. Also, the population in a hospital is kind of ripe for terrorism. We got children, we got women, we got sick people, we got families, and the terrorists can take over a hospital, and then they've got a ready population of hostages. And then we also talked about what are the effects of a terrorist attack against a hospital. You know, in some places they've done a primary attack elsewhere and then done a secondary attack at the hospital. Think of what would happen, you know, like the Boston Marathon bombing. If somebody showed up in the emergency rooms with an explosive vest and lit it off there.
Yeah, true.
So that would be a devastating thing against the community, and it's been done, and it's part of the MO. So it's not something that they haven't heard of before. They've already done it. It's one of their favorite things. And so the other thing is, you know, are our hospitals prepared for stuff like that?
No, I don't think so.
No,
they're not. You know, several things that we have to look at. One is people can bring whatever they bring in, their suitcases, their bags. Nobody's searching bags. There's no metal detectors. A lot of the security people are unarmed. They have tasers or pepper spray or whatever, but they don't have firearms. And you know, if I were a guy that's making $20 an hour to carry a taser, and some guy comes in with an AK-47, I'm heading out the door the other way.
I think most of them would, yes.
And so, you know, so we're all left, you know, unprotected. And so this is the thing that I'm most concerned about. The other thing is, you know, is there a plan to secure the emergency room from somebody like a suicide bomber? After an attack in the city itself, is there a plan for searching ambulances and vehicles before they even approach a hospital to make sure there's no explosives? And most places, the answer to that is no. And so these are the questions that I brought up in my talk that I gave at Gun Rights Policy Conference. And I think it's stuff that we all need to look at in our local hospitals, wherever you are in your place. We need to ask the hard questions of the security people at our hospitals. And don't forget schools. The other place that's a wide open is like Super Walmarts and Super Kmarts. They're a perfect place to have a hostage situation, too.
Let me stop you right there for a second. You talked about the speech you gave at the Gun Rights Policy Conference. That's available on YouTube, isn't it?
It's on YouTube. You can actually look at it through the Polite Society podcast.
Okay.
And also, Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership, we also have a page, and it's on that as well. So you can see it on YouTube. It's about a 30-minute presentation.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, we need to be talking to our hospitals. We need to approach them. But, you know, the thing is, you being a physician, you, I'm sure, know how to talk to the administration of a hospital. But what about the ordinary citizen? What should they do?
Well, I think that you can ask the hospital administration, what is your security plan?
But also
the police department and the sheriff's department, I think they need to be involved in this stuff too. You know, the Homeland Security. You know, in fact, Bexar County Medical Society has an emergency preparedness committee. I'm on that committee.
Oh, you are?
And I put myself on, I volunteer for that committee for this very reason, because these are the things that I'm concerned about. I wrote an article that appeared in their journal earlier this year, and it's called "The Unthinkable: An Active Shooter in a Hospital," and it talks about, you know, what you should do if you're involved in it, but it also asks some hard questions. Why don't we have hospital staff that are trained and armed? Why aren't we coordinating with the police departments and the sheriff's departments to put a cadre of people in place? We know that if the shooting starts, it'll be over long before the police ever get there.
Oh, of course. It always is.
Yes.
It's always over before the cops get there.
Exactly. And so the only people who have a chance of stopping this are the people who were there at the time, either by, if they are armed, being able to counterattack, or, as Anthony Calandro likes to say, rush the nut. So everybody has to go after the guy at once, because he can't kill all of you at once. If you have 10 people coming after the guy, he's not going to be able to shoot all 10 of you until you get to him.
But wait a minute. I like what you just said. And, you know, not to get political, because a lot of people know that I try to stay away from politics on this show. But, you know, Dr. Ben Carson just said that.
when he was asked what he would have done in the Oregon shooting. He said, well, I would have rushed the guy. I certainly would have not let him shoot everybody. And he's been lit up and flamed, and absolutely people have tried to destroy him for saying that.
I think he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
I think that that's if you're left with no other tools other than your hands and whatever you have is an improvised tool, the best defense is a good offense. I mean, you're going to stand there and just let him shoot you? No, you're going to fight back. Anybody who's not been trained to be a sheep is going to fight back. The problem is the population now is being trained to be sheep.
Of course. Yeah, that's the problem.
All right. Sorry, folks. We had to pause. We were in a room, and we had kind of got shooed out of the room. And so now John makes his first appearance in the Handgun World Mobile Studio. What do you think?
I'm liking it.
Nice, luxurious ride, isn't it?
Absolutely, and it's cool.
Hey, it's cool. The air conditioner's cranked. We were just talking about, you were saying people are raised as sheep. And I couldn't agree more. The thing is, you know, John, what's your opinion? Why do you think so many folks are being raised as sheep these days?
It's about control. Is that, the powers that be want people to be passive so that they can be dictated to and become dependent. This is America. You know, we were founded on independence. Our founding fathers, for much less than what we're putting up with right now, revolted. I just don't know how... I'm just not wired that way. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, neither am I. You know, and this population of sheep that we have... I think it's going to take a long time, and we may never even be successful at getting the majority of the people to kind of wake up and figure out what's going on. A lot of people think that we are in good shape with our gun rights, and although we've made some great advances and great strides lately, what do you think?
Yeah, no, there's still a long way to go, and it depends on where you're at. I mean, I grew up in New Jersey. I know you were born in New York. Two really horrible states for personal rights. Not just gun rights, but search and seizure laws. I mean, look at your amendments. First Amendment, Second Amendment, Fourth Amendment. At least they're not putting soldiers in our houses yet, at least anyway.
It's coming.
Yeah, that's the Third Amendment, by the way, if you don't
yeah.
know.
Yeah, that's right.
They have, stop and frisk. They have all that kind of stuff in New York. That may help the crime, but that's certainly... not what the founding fathers envisioned as being a free America.
No. You know, I was born in New York City. Fortunately, I was not raised in New York City. But I think that we have a situation now where, and I talked about this a few months ago when I did a podcast episode called Gun Culture 2.0. And I had Rob Morse and John Richardson on there, and I was interviewing with them. And I think that was actually also aired on the Polite Society podcast. Mm-hmm. Gun Culture 2.0 is good to see, but the problem is we still have a lot of people that haven't grown up around guns, and that's the big problem that we have right now. Would you agree?
To some degree, although we have a generation of guys that fought in the sandbox, like guys like Ben, who get it.
Who's that?
Ben Branham.
Ben Branham?
Yeah, that's some other podcast guy.
The big goofy-looking Marine.
Yeah, that guy.
Oh, that guy. Yeah, yeah, all right, good.
Yeah, the big teddy bear. He's a good guy.
Yeah, he is.
He's good people. But anyway, yeah, I mean, we have a whole generation of guys who have fought and died and bled for this country, and they get it. And now a lot of these guys are starting to become political. They're starting to, we have a SEAL that's a congressman. And we've got a lot of guys that were former military that are in positions of authority. So I think there's still hope. And our young people are getting smart, too. There's a lot of, the Internet is great for communication and getting the word out. And, although we have our kids who are, video game junkies who will never get their heads out of their video games, the Internet is useful. I mean, even Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership uses the Internet to communicate with like-minded people. We put out a couple of blogs every week. We comment on the research that's done by Bloomberg and by the NIH. We certainly are indebted to Dr. John Lott, because he is the man when it
Absolutely.
Comes to debunking all the garbage that Absolutely. These guys are coming out with. You know, I don't believe a study until John Lott has looked at it and said, yeah, this is legit or this isn't legit.
Yep. Anything that John Lott puts out is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, he picks it out. It's interesting how they try to put out studies where they are very selective about the years they include so that it actually reflects what they want to, you know, and if they included 5 years before, it flips the results upside down.
Yeah, you can make statistics say anything that you want them to say.
Exactly. So, you know, fortunately, you know, we have, you know, doctors are quote unquote scientifically trained. I mean, we learn about scientific method. So we at least can look at a study and at least have an idea whether it's worthwhile or not. Although, you know, when you actually look at the numbers, he actually pulls up the raw data because he's got access to that stuff, you know, the FBI studies and, you know, the government studies. And he'll put together the whole study and look at it and go, oh, yeah, I can see what they did. That's how they fudged the numbers. And yeah. So we can't believe anything that comes from Bloomberg because it's junk science.
Yeah.
In fact, Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership actually got started because of the NIH. Tim Wheeler was actually out there he actually testified in front of Congress to defund the NIH, and Congress actually did it.
For people who may not know, you're talking about the National Institute of Health, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And back in the mid-90s, they were putting out all this junk science, and it was a totally Second Amendment stuff. And we didn't have a John Lott who was out there in the midst of things at that point in time. So actually, Tim Wheeler is at least partially responsible for blowing the whistle on these guys, and the Congress listened and they put a stop to this anti-gun stuff.
You know, and I'm glad you bring up John Lott. I just recently sent a small donation to his Crime Prevention Research Center. And, folks, I would strongly urge that you do that. Google Crime Prevention Research Center and help John Lott out because, you know, there's a lot of money behind the anti-gunners. Bloomberg's not the only one. There's a lot of other money that's behind them. So let's help out the people that are on our side.
Absolutely. I've sent him money, too.
Yeah. You know, John, I know that one of your passions is the elimination of gun-free zones. And I don't think I've met anybody more passionate than you about doing that. Tell the listeners that might be thinking, okay, I'm in agreement, we should get rid of gun-free zones, but what should we do about it? What can the average listener do? What could be a first step?
Well, I think, you know, in Texas where we're at, a lot of it is legislated. The 30-aught, the famous 30-aught-6 sign and soon to be the 30-aught-7 signs, you know, basically tell us where we can and can't conceal carry. The only way we're going to get rid of gun-free zones, say, in hospitals, is the legislatures are going to have to repeal those laws or to amend them in a way that, you know, allows us to carry in public places where right now we're not allowed to. Now, as far as private property goes, certainly people have the rights to their own private property and to tell people who should go there and who shouldn't go there, whether you're armed or not, and that's fine. However, there's also a responsibility to those same people if they disarm a law-abiding person and don't provide security and something else happens. You know, say there's a robbery, a shooting, and people are hurt. Who's responsible for that? Are we going to have to start getting serious with, you know, I hate to throw lawyers in there, but bringing lawsuits against people who disarm us and then, you know, leave us wide open. Fortunately, that's a rare event, but who knows? And the other thing is, of course, you can vote with your dollar. If there's a business that says no guns allowed here, in fact, people have come up with cards that says, you know, no guns equals no dollars. And you give them the no guns, no dollar sign, and you say, I would have come here with all these people, but since you're a gun-free zone and I don't think your security is safe, we're going somewhere else.
Well, and you brought up something earlier. You know, we could maybe start asking the question, okay, if I can't carry my gun, Mr. Business Owner, what are you doing to provide for the security of me and my family?
Correct. I think that's a very reasonable question to ask. And some people, you know, they're not even aware that their policies are gun-free. You know, some of the managers in some of these places, you know, or why, or who put up to it. There was a lot of places that when you challenge them, you call the owner and they say, well, we didn't know there was a gun-free zone sign zone here.
The manager did
that. Yeah, the manager did it without any authorization from the owner. So, you know, sometimes you have to open your mouth and ask questions of the right people to find out, you know, truly is this, you know, legit or not. And if it is, well, then fine. Then you can vote with your dollars elsewhere.
You know, you brought up something earlier that probably only Texans are going to know, so I want to make sure that everybody else who's listening to this understands what we're talking about. There's now a new sign called the 30-07 sign because it's the statute 30.07, which is basically prohibiting open carry. So now Texas has a special sign to prohibit open carry. And what I think is interesting is open carry hasn't even taken effect yet. But they've already got the anti-open carry signs out there. Businesses can buy them and display them. And how do I know? Because the church I go to recently had one up. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, knuckleheads. Open carry hasn't even taken effect. It doesn't take effect until January 1, 2016. But yet, they got the anti-open carry signs.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess you don't want to wait till the last minute. But I think it gives you a chance to at least address that with maybe the leadership of the church and discuss, you know, whether is open carry a deterrent against church shootings? How many church shootings have we had in the last couple of years?
Too many. Too many.
You know, Gina Somm, she stopped it, you know, and she was one person who you know, put the brakes on a potentially large number of people being killed in a church.
And you know what I think is interesting here in Texas, and you know, leave it to politicians to screw things up. Okay, so we got a 30-06 sign, which says we can't conceal carry in that building. And then we have a 30-07 sign, which says that we can't open carry. So my question is, if they have a 30-07 up that says we can't open carry, does that mean that concealed carry is okay? And if they have the 30-06 sign, does that mean that we can't conceal carry, but we can open carry? And do they have to display both signs? That's the thing.
Yeah,
that's the question.
I think they have to display both signs if they want no carry. Because frankly, if it's not open carry, because there are some establishments that don't want open carry.
Yeah.
But concealed carry is fine. You know, it's kind of like if I can't see it, nobody else can see it. You know, we don't care. But if it's open, then we're a little bit more worried about it.
Don't you think this is going to be interesting? And trust me, this is going to happen. In fact, I'll give it about 30 days. And we'll see if it happens. Within 30 days after the open carry law takes effect, so it takes effect January 1, somebody is going to go into a building that has a 30-06 sign up that says no concealed carry, and they're going to open carry, and they're going to get in trouble.
Yeah, well, I mean, but they have a way of defending that, although they're going to have to take the ride, but they probably won't do the time. But it's going to cost them money. And, you know, the other thing is, if you get arrested for that, can you, you know, come back at the police for false arrest? Because they're arresting you based not on the statute, but by some weird interpretation. The law says concealed versus open, and if you're open and, you know, not concealed, you're abiding by the law.
Okay, so getting back to gun-free zones, you mentioned we can pressure our legislators. Yeah, we can do that, and we can pressure the business owners that display those signs and let them know that we're not going to be bringing our business there. Any other ideas?
I don't really know.
You know,
I don't have any other ideas.
I think, you know, I don't either. But I think that those two things right there, I think we've got to be very, we have to be very aggressive with that. Not offensive. There's a big difference between being offensive and aggressive.
Right.
We have to be polite, but very forceful and very aggressive to try to reduce the amount of gun-free zones.
Right. And I think the more, you know, with open carry, the more people that are open carrying, the more accepting of you know, firearms people are going to have. Unless you go to, like, UT Austin, where the professor is having a hissy fit and he says he's leaving.
Well,
if somebody's going to be able to carry in his room, in his office, and or in his classroom. I mean, I think that whole thing is absolutely ridiculous. I mean,
what, campus carry?
No, the controversy over campus carry.
Oh, yeah, it's well, and you know what's even more ridiculous? I don't know if you know this or not.
And again, here's how bad politicians screw things up. Campus carry also takes effect January 1, 2016. Okay? However, if you are a junior college, it does not take effect till January 1, 2017.
Right.
Junior colleges have to wait an extra year for those students to be able to carry. But if you go to a regular four-year college, then I guess you're smarter than the junior college people. So you get it, so that means you can start a year earlier. The junior college people are more dumb. I guess that's what it is, right?
Yeah, well, I guess so. I mean, those nice people in Oregon could have used a little concealed carry when, you know, last week or
yeah.
2 weeks ago. Whenever.
So let's talk about Oregon.
Yeah.
By the way, my previous comment did not mean to say that junior college people are dumb. I was being sarcastic, okay?
Yeah.
But let's talk about Oregon. So, once again, one of these shootings takes place where?
In a gun-free zone.
In a gun-free zone. And, you know, here's what drives me nuts. You know, we get politicians standing up there and saying, I'm getting sick and tired of talking about this stuff. Yeah, so am I. I'm getting sick and tired of these types of things happening in gun-free zones.
Well, I mean, I think it's immoral to keep them in place, frankly. We know that this is where the crazy people, the evil people go to commit violent acts because they know there's nobody that's going to be able to stand up to them with a firearm. You know, Masoud Ayoub, our hero, my hero, anyway, you know, it's they're you know, hunting grounds for psychopathic murderers. You know, and I mean, he said it best. I was sitting right next to him when he said it at a gun rights policy conference last year, and it was and I just. Now, the light bulb went on when he said that.
Most of the time, and this is not without exception, but most of the time, those are the places that these psychopaths pick.
Yeah.
They pick a gun-free zone. And like what we recently saw at that small little college out in Oregon, same thing. And again, I'm not trying to get political, but, you know, Donald Trump did say, he says, you know, if there would have been at least a couple of teachers in that college that had a gun, things might have turned out differently.
Right.
He did say that.
Or that the veteran who rushed the guy, if he had been armed, he could have stopped it right there, dead on the spot.
Yeah.
And then there was one guy who was armed, and they wouldn't let him go to the scene.
They wouldn't let him go.
So yep. You know, it's insane. You know, so it's better to let people die than to let somebody who's armed respond. Just because he's got a badge and a uniform, does it make him any more of a better person to stop this than a guy who's regular guy like you and me?
No, you know, John, it goes back to something you said earlier about 10 minutes ago or so. The fact that we can own and carry firearms means that we have a better chance of remaining free, that we're not going to give in to severe oppression. And truth be told, the people in power, and I'm talking about the politicians that don't want us to have guns, I think deep in their heart, that's what the issue is they do not want people to have the type of freedom that they can have because they can resist an oppressive government if they've got the arms. And it's all about control.
Yeah, and it's a balance of power issue.
Mm-hmm.
If the balance of power is with the people, then the government fears the people and we have freedom. When the balance of power is in the government, then the government has no fear of the people and you have tyranny.
You know, that's a good way to put it. I've always known that, but I've never heard anybody put it that way. And that's pretty good. It is. It's about the balance of power.
Yeah, it is. And when the government is afraid of the populace and they fear the power in the populace, then they're going to behave themselves. And they're going to, you know, and as long as we hold them accountable, and that's the problem right now, is that government is not being held accountable. They're able to do whatever they want to do. You know, our current commander in chief basically legislates from the White House now, and nobody's willing to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Congress doesn't want to stop it. You know, they can defund a lot of the stuff. You know, if the president does something and directs ATF to do something, Congress could defund the ATF. They could say, you know what, you could do all that stuff, but not on any money.
Yeah,
good
but,
luck.
But they don't have the guts to do that.
So, yeah, but they don't have, you know, and the leadership doesn't have the guts. Hopefully, maybe with a change of leadership coming up, we'll have a better group of people in leadership, but, you know, I'm not really optimistic.
Yeah, I'm not either. John, let me ask you something else. You know, you mentioned earlier you're a pediatric orthopedic surgeon and a talented one. There's not very many people who can do the kind of job that you do. So what do other doctors think about this whole firearms issue?
Well, surprisingly, we have a lot of discussions in the doctor's lounge in the operating room.
I bet you do.
usually I'm the one starting them up.
But no.
Yeah.
Why am I not surprised?
But you'd be surprised the number of people who are very pro-Second Amendment, especially amongst the surgical community.
Really? Why is that?
I think because we see the worst side of things.
Yeah.
You know, we see the trauma. We see, you know, and we're not in the ivory tower. You know, we're in the blood and guts, and we're in the mix of things.
So, don't the doctors apply pressure to the hospital administrators?
Yeah, but there's enough people who are in the ivory tower side of the house that. And plus, it's also a corporate thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of these hospitals are owned by large corporations, and even if you have an administrator who is actually willing to go along with it, by the time the corporate lawyers get done with it, it's so chopped up that it's worthless.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, and that's the other thing. Big corporations, you know, they have to feel the heat, and if you know if there is an attack at a hospital, and people are hurt. You know, the hospital's going to have to feel it in the pocketbook because that's the only place they're going to learn that, you know what, maybe this crazy doctor talking about, you know, having people carrying isn't such a bad idea.
Well, do you know of any instances where a hospital, where something happened, somebody got hurt or killed, and the hospital was held responsible?
Not yet.
No.
So as long as there's no, it never happens. And also there's, you know, there has to be legislation too. I think there has to be some laws.
Yeah.
But you know, you can, accountability is accountability.
Yeah, it is.
And if you're not providing adequate security, and, you know, I put it in writing in a journal article, so they can't say, oh, we didn't know about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I've talked with the senior administration.
And they can't use that excuse.
No, they can't say that they don't know, but, you know, there's a lot of other excuses they can use. And they put pressure on us, too, you know,
because
we are dependent on the hospital to make our living.
Yeah, yeah,
and
you
so
are.
So we don't want to, you know, we have to work together.
It's a very delicate situation.
Yeah, but you have to work together, and it has to be a win-win.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what I'm trying to do is make it a win-win.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk guns again specifically. I was impressed. Today you came to class with a Smith & Wesson 686 revolver. That's, for people who don't know, it's a 357, big stainless steel 357, and you were shooting 38s. And I got a chance to shoot that. What a sweet gun.
Oh, yeah. I love it. I actually bought it from Ben.
Yeah, from Sparks Firearms.
Yeah. But Ben was, yeah. And there was two of them sitting there, and I asked Ben, pick the one with the best trigger. So he dry-fired both of them, and he says, this is the best one. Take it. So
yeah. And I got to admit, Ben did a good job because the trigger is awesome. I think I shot about 10 to 12 rounds from it. I was impressed. So, why did you do that? Why did you come to class with a revolver?
Well, because I wanted, because I took that class with Grant Cunningham, and I just wanted to keep my skills up with the revolver. And I think that it's important to train, you know, with you know, whatever firearm you're going to have to use.
Yeah.
And you know, if I have a revolver around, I want to be able to train with it and use it. And I feel that I'm relatively competent with my Glocks, and
yeah.
I've certainly taken, you know, a bunch of courses with a Glock 19 or a Glock 17. I think it's as much of a novelty as it is, it's still a good defensive firearm, and boy, is it accurate.
It's
great.
It's incredibly accurate. Now, what kind of snub-nose revolver is that you had?
That's a Model 36, which is a five-shot J-frame with a hammer. It's not a shrouded hammer. It's actually got an exposed hammer. And it's 2-inch barrel or 1 7/8-inch barrel.
Well, you know, when I shot that, I was reminded once again why I don't like those.
Yeah.
They are just absolutely zero fun to shoot.
No, it definitely barks at you, and it hurts your hand.
It does. It hurts. Yeah. Now, you know, I've heard people say in a defensive situation, you're not going to care about that. And that's probably true. But here's the thing. If people have a gun that hurts them to shoot it, they're not likely to practice
with it. No, absolutely not. In fact, did you see me pull it out during the class and shoot it?
No, no, you didn't.
I shot the big gun because it's like shooting a Cadillac. You know, it's beautiful and smooth and comfortable to shoot. It doesn't beat on you. That little guy, if you shot it for probably half the class, I think you'd probably be ready to put it away.
Now, what about an in-between size revolver? I've always thought something like a Ruger SP-101 or something like that, being kind of in between a big one and a snubby, might be kind of cool.
Yeah, I think if you have enough weight to it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really a matter of physics. You know, if you have a gun heavy enough to dampen, and some of it is also ergonomics, too, the way they're put together.
Yeah.
But, you know, for instance, you know, even that Ben's LCR.
Ruger LCR. Yeah,
I mean, that gun being made out of polymer, I think, does dampen some of the recoil. It's not quite as punishing as a steel gun does.
No, it's not. I've shot his, and it's not quite as punishing.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I mean, you can't escape physics.
No, you can't escape physics, and it's the same thing even with small semi-automatics.
Right.
Same thing. You know, you get a small little lightweight 11 or 12 ounce 380 or whatever those things weigh, and you put 380 hot loaded 380 rounds in there, they're not fun to shoot.
Yeah, those little LCPs are, you know, they're not much fun to shoot.
LCPs, Kel-Tec P380s, which were actually the original, and Ruger copied them. They did.
Yep.
Nothing against Ruger, but let's all face it.
Yep.
We know that Ruger copied him. Now, of course, Ruger's become fabulously successful with that design. But sometimes those are not very fun to shoot either.
No, but you know, if you go up a size, then it's really not so bad. So if you go to the Ruger
Glock 42,
yeah, LC9, the Glock 42,
yep,
those are a little bit easier to live with.
I'm talking about 380s.
Yeah.
Oh, the LC9s and 9mm.
If you're going up to the 9s, though.
I think the Glock 42, and not just because I'm a Glock fan, I think the Glock 42 is one of the sweetest shooting guns. And for a 380, I mean, my goodness, that thing is fun to shoot.
Yeah, no, it's nice. It's nice and smooth, and it's not punishing at all. The extra size of that gun, I think, really makes it a perfect 380.
Yeah.
Just because it doesn't recoil, it's not punishing, and for new shooters with small hands, it's not a bad gun to teach people on.
Well, I'm impressed that you came and you took this course with the revolver. I mean, it was a lot slower to reload, but you know what? You made your six shots count every time that you pulled that thing out. And I think that's the most important thing is, you know, making those shots count right away.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, because if you don't, if you're wasting them, you run out pretty quickly. And it takes time to reload, especially on the move. And, of course, in this class, you're doing a lot of moving. So it makes it even more difficult. It's certainly a lot easier to run a semi-auto.
A big revolver like that, I think, would be a great home defense gun.
Oh, absolutely. And especially if you put in plus Ps. I don't know if you necessarily want to put in hot-loaded 357 magnums just because of the over-penetration issue going through walls and things like that. But, you know, the plus P rounds still have pretty good velocity and good expansion.
Is that a 4-inch barrel on that 686?
It's a 4-inch barrel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a 6-inch barrel one at home, too.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
You got a 6-inch barrel Smith & Wesson 686?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I bought it 20 years ago, and it's been a safe queen for a long time. But, you know, in fact, when I decided to take that revolver course, I said, well, I can't take it with this big, long barrel gun. I can't get it out of the holster. So I went, but I liked the gun because I really liked the way it handled and liked the way it shot. So I found a 4-inch model, and it was a great choice.
You know what you just said, John? I want to key in on that. You know, you said it takes too long to get out of the holster. I don't know. There are a lot of people that might not realize that, but if you are shooting like in a competition or even if you're in defensive training, sometimes people don't realize how much longer it can take you to draw a long-barreled gun out of a holster.
Right.
That's one reason why I like firearms the size of Glock 19s or M&P compacts or XD compacts, because they just snap right out of that holster fast.
Right, and that, you know, and some people don't have the mobility in their shoulder.
Correct.
And so, and if they're wearing, high waisted pants with a holster up high, They may have a very difficult time clearing. A lot of women, especially because their anatomy is a little bit different,
right,
have a real hard time clearing long-barreled guns out of a holster.
Correct,
because
correct.
They wear their belts on top of their pelvis, and guys tend to wear it about sitting over the mid part of the pelvis.
Correct, correct.
So that becomes a real issue when you're talking about teaching women how to shoot and run a gun out of a holster.
Yeah, exactly. So don't forget that, folks. If you're listening to this, it might be kind of appealing to have a long-barreled gun because, okay, you can be more accurate, you got a longer sight radius, usually it softens up recoil a little bit, but, getting that gun out of holster, which is very, very important, the draw and the first couple shots, as we learned today in Beyond Concealed Carry, those are the most important. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. As soon as you can degrade the attacker, the better. Because the sooner you can get rounds into him, that means his ability to get rounds into you goes down. And we may not always, get lucky and not get shot if we ever have to get into an armed encounter. But the more rounds you can put in him, the faster, the better for you.
So you took Beyond Concealed Carry with us the second time. Was it any different?
Yeah, it was hotter. When I took it the first time, it was freezing rain.
It was freezing rain.
It was cold. But it was fun. It was... And again, when you're training under those conditions, you really learn how to operate your equipment.
Yeah.
You learn what works and what doesn't work. And so there's always benefit from even taking the same class twice. You learn stuff the second time that you didn't pick up the first time.
Oh, absolutely. You can't learn and retain everything the first time. Now, you're signed up for our advanced class November 21st and 22nd. Beyond Concealed Carry Advanced, and Chaz Murray's coming down. He's going to be one of the instructors. Tracy Thronberg, a Masada U Group instructor, she's coming down from Austin, Texas. And then Ben and I are going to teach the second day, and we're going to teach the advanced techniques of Beyond Concealed Carry. You looking forward to that one?
Oh, absolutely. The up close and personal stuff. You had a course that had a lot of that same material in, and I did that up in Dallas with Ben.
Yep. Oh, that's right. You went to Dallas. Yeah.
And so that type of point shooting, hip shooting, if you want to call it that, when you're up close like that, that may be the only chance you get to get your shot off.
Yeah.
So you need to be able to be the first guy out of the holster and get shots on target. And you may not be able to, if you're in bad breath distance, you're not going to be able to get your arm extended to get your normal stance. So.
Well, and you shouldn't extend your...
No, you don't want to give him the gun.
No.
Heck no.
Okay, last question, John. I know you own a lot of firearms, and you don't have to tell people in public what they are, but which side of the concealed carry argument or stance do you fall on? Do you fall on the side that people should find one type of gun that they like and just train and carry that and only that? Or do you like to switch out and encourage people to try and carry different things?
Well, I think that it depends on your situation. There are some places where a lot of it has to do with the kind of clothes you have to wear and what you can conceal. If, for instance, if we ever did get rid of the stupid gun-free zone signs in the hospitals, would I carry my Glock 19 in a inside the pants holster wearing scrubs? No, I can't do that. I have to wear a belly band, and so I'd probably I'd probably downsize a little bit, and so I might go with the Shield. But as it stands right now, if I'm wearing regular clothes, I'm going to either carry the G19 or the G26, and unless I'm really have to go small, and I can either go to the Shield or the Glock 43.
But all those you just mentioned, Glock 26, Glock 43, Glock 19, Smith & Wesson Shield, those are all basically the same kind of platform.
Exactly. They operate the same operating system.
Yeah, so you're a fan of that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You're a fan of that. You're not a fan of switching between platforms.
No, I started off shooting a 1911, I took Rob Pincus's course, and he talks about efficiency. And I think that the striker-fired firearms, the modern striker-fired guns, are the most efficient. There's no buttons, switches, or anything else you got to operate. It's kind of like an old camera, point and shoot, baby. That's all you got to do, point it and press the trigger and shoot it, and it's going to go bang. You want absolute reliability if you ever have to save your life. And this is a life-saving tool. It's not, you know, it's not a toy. If you want to play with toys, great, and that's fine. And, you know, the revolver to me is kind of a toy. But, you know, when it comes down to business, I'm going to carry a striker fire, you know, firearm and with as much ammunition as I can conceal, basically.
Well, the reason I asked you that is because, you know, I read stuff, and maybe you've read it too, or you've heard people talk like this. They'll say, well, last week I was carrying my 1911, and today I got my XD, and, you know, I think next month I'm going to do some more carrying of my revolver, and they'll start switching, and then maybe the Beretta after that, and they'll start switching different platforms. Do you think that's a wise idea?
No, I don't think so at all. In fact, under the stress of a, you know, a life-threatening encounter,
yeah,
you know, you're most likely going to forget. You're going to default to whatever thing that you use the most.
Exactly.
And so if you carry a Glock most of the time and you're carrying the 1911, I can almost guarantee you that thumb safety is still going to be on when you're pressing the trigger.
Exactly.
And you're going to be behind the power curve.
Yep, exactly.
So we definitely want to, I think you have to be consistent with your training. And I think, you know, you did your experiment last year with the 1911 versus the striker fired.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you train consistently, whatever you are comfortable with will work. But you got to be consistent. And that's really the most important thing, is consistency of whatever training you're going to take and whatever firearm you're going to use.
Yep, good. Well, Dr. John Adine, thank you very much. Why don't you go ahead and refresh people's memory as to where they can find Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. I can never say that.
Yeah, it's easy for you to say, isn't it?
it's
drgo.us, and we have Facebook as well.
Hang on one second.
So you can find us at drgo.us for our main website. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter.
Okay, good. Dr. Adine, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. John always has some very insightful things to say. Like I said, he's a very good shooter as well. He's an excellent doctor, and he just is a great asset for the pro-gun community. So, Dr. John Adine, thanks again for interviewing with me. Check out the website drgo.us. That's Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. DRGO.us. And let's see, the next thing I want to say is about the 327 Magnum, 327 Federal Magnum. I guess Ruger is out with that now. Ruger is selling the Ruger LCR revolver in 327 Federal Magnum. Like I said, what I like about that, that might be something that I would strongly consider adding, because I do not own a revolver at this time. One thing I like about it is 6-shot capacity in a snub-nosed revolver instead of 5-shot. And the 327, supposedly, if you read about it and do some research on it, the 327 Federal Magnum is supposed to be a little more powerful than the 38, although you know how I feel about power in a handgun. There's a lot of them that are pretty much the same, but it's supposed to have less recoil than a 357, but a little bit more punch than a 38. I don't know, go figure. But I just like the fact that it's a decent cartridge. It's got some decent, it'll do the job, and ammo is available. Spear Gold Dot makes 327 Federal Magnums, hollow points. There are some fairly decent practice ammunition rounds for it. It is a little over 50 cents a round for practice ammo, so it's a little on the high side. I guess that's one of the disadvantages if you were to have a gun like that, is that the ammo is relatively expensive. And you know, you can find it out there, though. It's not like it's a scarce ammo that you can't find. You know, I'm looking at, for example, you can buy some practice ammo right now for about $27 for a box of 50. Yeah, that's kind of high, but it is Federal American Eagle, 327 Federal Mag, 100 grain, $27.59 for a box of 50, and then, like I said, it's about a buck a round for the Spear Gold Dot. defense ammo, which that's pretty typical. You know, 9mm is about the same thing, about a buck 20 a round. That's nothing. When you think about the cost of protecting your life, $1, $1.50 a round, $2 a round, I don't even care if it costs $5 a round. If it's something that I know is going to effectively save my life, yeah, my life's worth $5 per round of ammo. How about yours? Is your life worth $5 a round? Your life worth $2 a round? $1.20 a round? How do you put a price on saving your life? Is your life worth a $400 training class? I think it is. I think your life's worth a $400 training class. How about the wife of your spouse, wife of your kid? Is that worth a $400 training class? You see where I'm going with this? Why do you have a gun? You have a gun because in case you need it to save your life, it will do the job. And you need to be able to do the job as well. That's why. These are life-saving devices. And I wish that's what more people referred to when they talk about guns, that these are life-saving devices, because that's really what they are, and that's really why good people have guns. And the only, you know, it's the good people that have guns, they are the only people that these politicians are limiting with their goofy laws. So, with all that said, I do want to ask you if you would do me a favor. I want to ask if you would support my show. I don't have a lot of sponsors. I don't have any sponsors, actually. Mostly by design. But I do ask that you support my show so I can keep doing what I'm doing if you benefit from this show. As you know, those who are members of the Shooters Club and, of course, any listener can participate in our gun giveaway. And I'm giving away my XDS, the XDS 9mm that I purchased a few months ago. And Ben and I have run it through the paces, and it's working great. If you are a member of the Shooters Club or you take advantage of our free entry system, which I'll explain in a minute, you could win that gun on December 24th, 2015. All you have to do is produce a video, 45 seconds to 60 seconds in length. All you got to do is record a video, talk about whether you like the Handgun World podcast or Modern Self-Protection podcast or both, or what you've learned from listening to us or coming to our classes. Send that, email that to bob@handgunworld.com. That's my email address, bob@handgunworld.com or handgunworld@gmail.com. Or you can email it to ben@modernselfprotection.com. So if you do that, you're going to be assigned a number, and that's a free way that you can enter our contest. Okay, there's no purchase that's necessary to do that. If you're a Shooters Club member, you're going to get a little bit of an extra benefit. You'll get two numbers, okay? So that's a little bit of a reward. I mean, those of you who are Shooters Club members, you support us. You also get great educational videos, 35 or 36 videos that you can watch exclusively, password-protected videos, for only $8 a month or $75 a year. You do have to be an active member to get your two numbers on giveaway day, December 24th. We're also giving away to five different people. We're giving away an On Your Six Designs holster, and also all Shooters Club members next year are going to get 15% off of any class that Ben teaches and myself. I'm not sure how much I'm going to be able to do next year in teaching. Not much at all, but Ben, I know, is going to be teaching a lot of classes. Next year, by the way, folks, I am dedicating myself, number one, to my family. So I got to be home as much as I absolutely can and get, you know, leaving for 4 days on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday is pretty tough right now. Given my family situation. You know, you have to think about this. If I go teach a two-day class on Saturday and Sunday, it's 4 days for me. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Friday and Monday are travel days. Let me grab this real quick, and I'll be right back. All right, sorry about that. Had to take a business call and make some money in my real job. Anyway, so the Shooters Club. So I covered that. Just go to shootersclubmembers.com or go to handgunworld.com and click the Shooters Club page. Also, Christmas is coming up. You're probably going to be buying Christmas presents for people, and I bet you're going to go to Amazon.com and get some of those presents. Would you please go first to handgunworld.com and use my Amazon store? All you got to do is make two clicks. Just go to handgunworld.com and click my Amazon store. Do that every time you go to Amazon. If you do that, I'll get some credit for the purchases that you make. You get the same Amazon price, and of course, Amazon will pay me a little bit of a commission. And of course, that helps support the show as well. Last but not least, there are spots available for the Beyond Concealed Carry Advanced class, November 21st and 22nd. That's probably going to be the last class that I'm going to be involved in as an instructor for a while. November 21st and 22nd, Chaz Murray and Tracy Thronberger are also going to be instructors. You're going to have four instructors for 2 days. How cool is that? And then next May, you'll see on my website, John Payne from Suarez International is coming in to teach a carbine class in San Antonio, and Ben and I are going to be students in that one. All right. That pretty much wraps up this episode. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Handgun World Podcast. I'm Bob Main. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. And remember, evil does not exist in the holster. It exists in the hearts of man. Shoot straight. Shoot safe. Catch you next week. Goodbye. Then they